at all. What made you so late getting home from your golf date last night?
Oh, dear, it's a harrowing story.
Oh?
The man I played with had to catch a plane for San Francisco, and I offered to drive him to the airport.
Another last-minute rush, I suppose.
Oh, no, no, dear. We left the club in plenty of time. But about 3 blocks away, my friend asked me to go back because he had forgotten his hat. Well, we started again, got about 2 miles on our way, and he found he had forgotten his plane ticket. So back to the club again.
Well, no wonder you were late.
And that isn't all. On our third attempt, we were halfway to the field when he slapped his hand to his head and said, "My word, I've forgotten my wife." And that's the reason I was so late for dinner.
Well, your friend would probably head the list of absent-minded people. But so many of us are absent-minded these days that not too many people worry about it.
I'm sure, Verrie, that the average absent-minded person has no cause for alarm. But when this affliction becomes serious, then we should do something about it. We've all, of course, heard of the proverbial absent-minded professor. I think that his absent-mindedness comes from the fact that he concentrates so much on his other work, studious work, that he neglects everything else. That accounts for his absent-mindedness, I believe. But a New York businessman recently paid over $200 to a professional safecracker to have his new safe blown open. He'd forgotten the combination. In Chicago, an elderly woman wearing a shabby red dress applied for city relief. She couldn't remember where she had hidden her life savings. Then in Los Angeles, a man appealed to the county court to send him a record of a marriage which had been performed 15 years ago. He had forgotten his wife's name.
Oh, I think that happens very often.
Now, yourself, how many of the young people whom you knew intimately when you were in school in your teens, can you remember their first names? Or their last names?
Do you know that that's a very strange thing, you're asking me that, because the other day I was thinking of that very thing, and I thought, well, now, why is it that I cannot recall certain things in my life? They're little empty spaces, let us say. Now, of course, there are means of, let us say, bringing these back into your mind, because we know that absent-mindedness is simply caused by the fact that at the time of the incident, you were not concentrating completely. In other words, you did not give it your undivided attention. And that is something that happens so often with all of us. We are very much interested in certain things. And if we are sufficiently interested, if it's only for a fraction of a minute, we'll never forget that. But generally speaking, we go through our daily lives in such a hectic sort of way, and there's so much speed in the world today that we don't have time to concentrate on all these things.
The present-day study of the mind, of course, is a very interesting one. Now, take the person, for example, who can remember the remote past with incredible clarity,
yes,
but he cannot remember the immediate past.
Now, that happens to elderly people. Have you noticed that?
Well, now, the late John Barrymore, he wasn't elderly when he passed on. He could remember incidents in his early career of the plays he played in and the casts and the people in them, but he could not remember what he had done 15 minutes before. Now, I don't know whether this is a mental affliction or an illness of some kind.
I don't know.
Or whether it happens to all people.
No, but I was thinking more, dear, in terms of people in their 70s and 80s, you know. If you talk to any person in that age bracket, they'll all have a crystal clear picture of things that happened in their youth. I don't know whether it is because the immediate present has lost interest, and therefore they, without realizing it, go back into the memory box and bring out those things that happened in their youth. But they'll all be so clear about things that happened 40 and 50 years ago.
Well, now, I'll find myself, for example, trying on the spur of the moment. Sometimes my mind will be utterly clear and can click like lightning.
Yeah.
And then I will try to remember, for example, the name of an orchestra leader.
Mm-hmm.
I had the two confused the other day. I was trying to think of Duke Ellington or King Cole. And the fact that Duke and King were in it, I knew that there was something connected with a royal title of some kind, and I could not get the coal out.
Well, you know,
I
have a little trick that works for me, at least, that if I cannot remember a person's last name, I'll start with the alphabet and start with the letter A, and just in my mind think, now, does it begin with A or B, C, D, and go right through the alphabet, and you usually will, it'll suddenly click in your mind when you come to the proper letter.
Well, I think with concentration and study, a person can overcome any absent-mindedness.
Of course.
Now, we used to do a little trick with Peter when he was very young. I would have him look at a table and look at it with a clock for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. It would be cluttered with all sorts of things. I said, Peter, you look at it carefully, examine the table, and at the end of 5 minutes, you turn around and tell me everything you saw.
Mm-hmm.
This is a method of trying to train the mind for observation and remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find difficult crossword puzzles the most wonderful help in recalling words, places, incidents, and I do them every Sunday. I find I get a tremendous satisfaction from doing them. They also help the mind tremendously.
Well, now, there are certain things, though, I think that we can all do to help our absent-mindedness. Now, this is one of the tests that you can give yourself that's been handed down by people who are in a much a better position to know whether these things work or not than I do, certainly. This comes from two professors from the University of Pennsylvania. They suggest you doing something like this. Select some enjoyable incident from the past, something that you can bring to mind very easily. Now then, you sit down, and with complete concentration, you try and relive that entire incident, remembering everything about it, every simple little detail, where it happened, what kind of a day it was, if it was something out of doors, what the scenery was like. Try to bring to your mind the color, the texture, the time, everything pertaining to that. Now, that's a wonderful test. Now then, after you have done that and have achieved that, which we can do quite easily, then the next thing to do is to pick a time in your day, say between 2 and 3 o'clock of an afternoon. And you say, now this afternoon I'm going to remember everything I do during that time. And you try to. Now then, tonight, you try and relive that and see how much you have retained.
Well, I think it's only with that kind of exercise that one can avoid absent-mindedness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, dear, it always seems to me that the human animal is the only one that is troubled by things like absent-mindedness and afflictions of that kind.
Yes, the lower animals do not seem to have nervous disorders that are apparent to the average person, but I suppose a specialist in animal disorders might have a different story. I imagine the men who handled all the work animals in the army probably found temperament and temper, too.
Especially in mules. There is nothing more temperamental than a Missouri mule. I think we might talk about the different animals that have been used as parts of various fighting forces, but first I think we had better listen for a moment to someone else.
Today, Adolf, we are inclined to believe that warfare is wholly mechanized. But even now, many animals are an important adjunct to armies. You know, there are crises when the field commander finds it impossible to move their equipment and their supplies by machine through the jungle swamps or over the Rocky Mountain trails or through heavy snows. And, of course, that's the time when they have to call in whatever animals are available in that part of the world they happen to be fighting. And under those conditions, we have such things as mules and horses and donkeys and elephants, oxen, llamas, dogs, reindeers, camels, and I can't think of any others, but I'm sure there probably are, called in.
I'm sorry, you forgot one very important animal,
what?
And that is the homing pigeon.
Oh, yes, but he's not going to pull any machinery over the Alps.
But he is very important
in the
signal corps for sending messages when there are no other means. Now, in the First World War, I happened to have been stationed during the Argonne-Meuse drive in a little French village called Civry-la-Perche, 2 miles from the fortress of Verdun. And right next to my headquarters, in a farmhouse, in the stable of the farmhouse, was a hospital. 4 horses and mules.
Mm.
And I saw the incredible stamina of the mule. Now, the veterinary in charge told me that if they could get an animal to stand on his 4 feet for any length of time, that they could cure him.
You mean if he was ill?
If he was ill, yes. These are all wounded horses.
Oh, I see.
Either wounded or ill.
Yes.
Or sick.
Mm-hmm. Sick.
And if they could get him on his 4 feet, they could cure him. But if they couldn't, they had to do away with him.
Oh.
Now, the mules could stand the most incredible punishment. Shrapnel wounds, high explosive wounds, with great stoicism, without any show of pain at all. And they'd stand the cleaning and, you know, the antiseptic dressings that went on without any trouble at all.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very sturdy animal. Now, of course, in mountainous warfare, mules are used extensively. And they're very smart and very sure-footed and very courageous.
Well, now, of course, in Africa and India, they have the elephants that we know do all sorts of things, not only pertaining to warfare, but at other times, too, with the teak wood and all that sort of thing. They say they pull the tractors and the cranes through that part of the country where I don't suppose they could operate. There's nothing very new about using elephants in warfare, though, is it? We go back to the time of Hannibal, and that's...
Yes, where
when
he's
they
supposed
were used
to cross the Alps with elephants, but it was very easy to incapacitate an elephant. All you had to do was cut his trunk, and he was through.
What do you mean? Oh, of course, that's true.
They
could pull, couldn't they?
Oh, yes, but they used them for fighting. They used them in the vanguard to frighten people on account of their strength, but it was very simple. When you injured an elephant's trunk, he's out of business.
Now, during the First World War, didn't the British have a camel corps?
Oh, heavens, in North Africa, the French had a camel corps, and the British had a camel corps of 125,000 camels. They make it a business in those parts of North Africa and Arabia.
Is it true that they can go for such a long time without food and water, the camel?
Yes, I believe they can. If you give them sufficient water, they can last longer than probably any other animal because they are indigenous to the desert.
Yes.
The natives there, the Arabs, use them for everything. They use them for food,
And I believe that a very, very valuable reason, too, that they use them is the characteristic of the camel, that he doesn't get the least bit excited, even under heavy fire, that it doesn't seem to bother him very much, that he has no fear of the bullets and the noise going around him.
He's not a very friendly animal. In a picture I made many years ago with Rudolph Valentino called The Sheik,
yeah,
we used quite a few camels.
Yeah.
And they're not easy to handle. They have to be trained, and they have to be watched very carefully. They're vicious. They bite you.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and they have to be trained to sit and lie down so that one can mount them.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more difficult in the world to ride on than a camel. Mm-hmm. It's got a peculiar gait. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, in the Orient, the people use them extensively for all sorts of things. Now then, of course, we mustn't forget about the use of the dogs in war, which I believe we've spoken of before, mm-hmm. how very valuable the dog is. Mm-hmm. But we also mustn't forget the reindeer that the Laplanders use.
That's true, they do, don't
oh,
they?
Oh, heavens yes.
Well, but they use oxen.
They use oxen in countries. Let's take, for example, in the interior of a country like Hungary.
Oh.
In the farm sections, when you could not get mules, you would use oxen mm-hmm. to pull you out of a hole or mm-hmm. to pull a piece of artillery out. Mm-hmm. They're very strong, very sturdy, very patient, mm-hmm. and with, of course, the most incredible strength. I don't know why they don't use ox power instead of horse power, but they don't. ox power because it's much, much stronger than horse power.
I see. Well, once again, dear, I'm afraid we'll have to bring this little talk to a close and say our goodbyes. This is Berites d'Almanjou speaking from Beverly Hills.
And this is Adolphe Manjou thanking you for the pleasure of this visit and hoping that you will invite us to visit with you again soon.